First case is 04-1548, Thelma Badger versus John McGregor, M.D. Mr. Lozzi.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Lozzi. I represent Mr. and Mrs. Badger in this matter of the appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there on the clock, Mr. Lozzi.
Thank you. The law of Ohio is and should remain that when looking at the issue of informed consent in a medical negligence case, that the reasonable patient standard should apply and does apply today. There's good reason that that law has been followed in this state, as evidenced by the Ohio Judicial Conference product, the OJOR Ohio jury instruction that was applied in this case. If we remove the patient from the process of deciding what is important to the patient, then it puts the patient at a real detriment in trying to provide for their own care. We as lawyers owe a duty to our clients to keep them informed, to make them aware of what's going on, to allow them to participate in that decision. To remove that as a standard would simply allow the lawyers to make all the decisions and is not what we follow in our ethical considerations. And I will represent to the court that that is not what the physicians follow in their relationship, their patient-doctor relationship. They have an ethical duty as well to keep their patients fully informed. In this case, the issue in Ohio has been decided for decades. It was decided in Nickel. It was evidenced by the Ohio Judicial Conference's standard jury instruction, which in its comments clearly show that if they wanted to change a standard other than the reasonable patient standard, they could have applied that. They allowed for exceptions that said, if the patient's unable to participate, unable to make a decision, then under emergency circumstances, when we come to court, the standard will require medical expert testimony. Here, there is no edict in any case law, not from the Ohio Supreme Court, not in OJOR, as reviewed by several judges, not as reviewed by Judge Crawford in this case.
Counsel, though, isn't it, this is a medical negligence claim, is it not? Informed consent falls as a medical negligence claim. And in a medical negligence claim, do we not need an expert to testify as to the medical standard of care? In other words, what should a physician have done? What should a physician have said about a particular drug or interaction, whatever? But the idea being, if it's a negligence, medical negligence, we need to know how the breach of duty works here, specifically with regard to the physician who's in the case.
In this case, it makes no difference anyway with respect to Mrs. Badger. She was told nothing about the serious consequences that could result from the use of this drug. She was kept totally in the dark. The doctors decided what treatment she was going to receive, and that was the end of the debate. Is this a medical negligence issue? Yes, but is that the law here? No. The law has clearly been that what's important is, are there risks? Are they material? Did they occur? And would the reasonable person in the position of the patient have wanted to know those things before agreeing to or submitting to that care? That just wasn't done here.
Counsel, are you asking this court to establish a standard that an expert witness is not required in? And under what circumstances would an expert witness not be required in a medical negligence case?
I'm not asking the court for a total elimination of medical expert testimony in informed consent cases. That's already established
here. It's already established that it's necessary.
It's necessary for certain parameters, not for the ultimate decision of what's important to the patient.
Well, isn't it what is material, and that is an industry standard to be established by an expert, a medical expert.
Well, that's certainly the debate here, but that's not what the law of Ohio has been. It's not what the law of several other states is, and it's not what, certainly not what the plaintiffs are asking to totally eliminate experts from the testimony. What's important is, what are the material risks? Is this something that could result in a serious consequence to the patient, and what's the likelihood that that could happen? All of that was done in this case. There's no question. The 10th District Appellate Court reviewed that. They clearly showed that we had experts there, Dr. Zaski, to talk about this drug, to talk about the alternatives that could have been used, to talk about the serious consequences which resulted here. Mrs. Badger has been severely injured as a result of the use of this drug. She had no choice. She was not given an opportunity to make her decision. And it's our position that that's what the law is, that's what the law should remain. Otherwise, we're going to eliminate an important personal right to the people in the state of Ohio by eliminating.
Well, I don't think that there's any argument that disclosure to the patient is mandatory, so that an informed consent can truly be given. I think our question here is, what standard is to be employed in the courtroom when it comes to establishing material omissions in an informed consent case, and whether or not an expert is necessary for that disclosure, for the establishment of that standard in the breach?
If the court is looking to change the law, then again, the appellants would say that is not something that should be done. What's not broken shouldn't be tried to be fixed. In this instance, the jurors are quite capable of assessing what the evidence is about a particular treatment, whether it's a medication or a procedure. Are we going to take away the trust that we have in jurors to make these kinds of decisions about whether or not a doctor should have told a patient like Mrs. Badger of the risks? Are we going to take that away from them and leave it to doctors to decide first in the medical facility, and then come into court and try to persuade a group of people that they are the ones that control it, and take away our trust in the jurors? I don't think that's what our court has done in the past, nor should it in the future.
Mr. Loza, you indicated at the outset of your argument, if I understood it correctly, that this reasonable person standard is what ought to be applied with respect to the position of the patient. Did I understand it correctly?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, there was an interrogatory that was returned in the case that indicated seven members of the jury indicated Dr. McGregor failed to discuss the potential side effects of this drug with Ms. Badger. Should there have been an interrogatory submitted then with respect to the fact that the reasonable patient would have decided against the therapy had that information been provided? Is that also an essential finding that maybe wasn't made in this case?
I believe the jurors had an opportunity to decide that based on the interrogatory that was offered and in conjunction with the instructions that were given by Judge.
But I didn't see an interrogatory that went to that issue is what my question goes to. And so, trying to follow your argument, assume for the moment that that is the standard. There really isn't a jury finding on that standard, but yet we have the finding with respect to the failure on the part of the physician, but we don't have the similar finding with respect to the third element under Nickel that you had proposed we should maintain.
In this case, there, as stated previously, Mrs. Badger was told nothing about the risks. The jurors knew that.
Having that status, though, wonder if the jury should be required to address whether or not that reasonable patient would have decided against the course of therapy having been established, because we sort of have a missing element, I guess, is what I'm suggesting.
And I think it's, in fairness to Mrs. Badger, that was covered by the instructions we felt, and that a special interrogatory was not necessary. Whether that could in the future be something that fine-tunes it, I couldn't argue with that as a possible argument for other future cases, but at least in this case, I don't believe it was necessary under these circumstances, under these facts, and with the instructions that were given.
Thank you.
Nickel was the...
Counsel, there was a general verdict form and there were interrogatories. Who propounded the interrogatories?
To the jury?
Yes.
It was a combination of, I believe, all of the lawyers and the judge.
Were there objections to them as they were finally propounded?
I believe there were some objections by Mr. Todaro.
Okay. And with respect to what, do you recall?
He objected to just the submission of the issue on informed consent, generally. Specifically as to that interrogatory, I can't from memory tell you what his objection, if any, to the specific interrogatory was, but generally it was that it shouldn't go to the jury. As stated earlier, this case follows the law of Ohio. Nickel versus Gonzalez sets out the standard of informed consent. I don't know how many people convene to go over the Ohio jury instructions on a regular basis, but I know it's reviewed by numerous lawyers. There's no compelling reason that plaintiffs see to change that. In fact, the compelling reasons are that it shouldn't be changed and that the patient should remain a vital part of this process.
Counsel, you know, the what we're talking about here is the gentamicin, the reaction to that. And as I read the record so far, there were a number of physicians involved in the care and treatment of your client. Wouldn't the expert testimony be helpful to the jury in determining who should have been the one to disclose any potential effects? I mean, the concern, and I understand it's a jury question, and certainly under Nichols we've already established the elements of the informed consent portion of the medical negligence. But here you do not have, or how can the jury tell without an expert saying, in the course of treatment, here is what should have been disclosed. Here it's when it should have been disclosed and what should have been disclosed.
Again, that, in our opinion, would take away from the jurors' opportunity to decide matters on the facts. In this case, the facts were that Dr. McGregor wrote this prescription. He was the attending physician for Mrs. Badger. Yes, there were several physicians, but he is the one who ultimately wrote the prescription. She left the hospital with that prescription.
But, counsel, he wasn't the first one to write that prescription.
He was not the first, but he was the doctor that prescribed this amount and for this duration. And the first regimen was for a short period of time and was changed. And then this was for a longer period of time at a much greater dose outside the hospital.
Was there testimony that indicated then that Dr. McGregor was the responsible physician here?
Yes, there was.
And who established that, being the medical standard?
As far as the medical standard, his testimony was that he was the attending physician, that he wrote the prescription, that he was aware of the side effects of this medication, and that he was aware.
Was there expert testimony that, as the attending physician, it was his responsibility to inform the patient?
No, that's why we're here today, is there was no testimony to the effect that he was had the duty to disclose certain things, and we just didn't feel that was necessary on our review of the law and don't believe it should be the law. Okay. Judge Crawford agreed with us. Judge Pertiz agreed with us. There is debate, obviously, or you wouldn't invite me here today. We'd respectfully request that the trial court's decision be upheld, that the law remain as it is, and I thank you for your time.
Losey, Mr. Todaro.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jerry Todaro. I represent the defendant appellees in this action, Dr. John McGregor and the Department of Surgery, former Department of Surgery Corporation. I'd like to take a moment just to address the two preliminary issues that I think underscore this case and are issues that we'd like to address before we talk about the duty of the responsibility in a medical malpractice case of having an expert witness establish duty and what that duty is in a medical malpractice case involving disclosure of risk and benefits of medical treatment. The first question is a factual predicate, and that precisely that predicate is this: whether a consultant's in-hospital medication order transferred to a discharge prescription by the attending physician imposes a duty on that attending physician to obtain the patient's informed consent. That was the factual basis that gave rise to the dispute with the court in terms of the instruction on informed consent and also the issue at the appellate level. At the appellate level, a different issue was raised, which we don't agree with. And that is, does a physician-patient relationship in and of itself by law impose a duty on the physician to obtain a patient's informed consent? And in this factual scenario, the answer to both of those questions is no. And the reason we say that is that in the medical reality today for physicians practicing in multiple specialty situations, if a patient at the corner of Broad and High is involved in a car accident and brought to a major medical institution here, that patient may be seen by four or five different specialists. There will be one attending admitting physician, maybe the on-call trauma surgeon. But that patient may be seen by a cardiologist because of a heart injury, an infectious disease doctor, an orthopod, a neurologist if there was a head injury, a myriad of physicians that will manage this patient given their skill and specialty. And in the course of that management, even if it's a week, there may be six, seven, eight prescriptions or various therapies administered by those physicians. When that patient leaves the hospital, as in the setting at Ohio State, someone sits down, generally a nurse for the attending physician, and inventories what's going on with this patient. When this patient leaves the hospital, what prescriptions they should take home. So these prescriptions may have already been given. The treatment may have already been provided. So the question here, and this was the heated debate at the trial level, of course, is whether an attending physician that is simply transferring medications previously provided by different specialists, such as an infectious disease doctor, has to bring the patient in and look at all the medications and say, okay, now we have to sit down and talk about all these medications you've had and re-inform that patient of all the risk and benefits. And on a broader scale,
but counsel, in this case, it wasn't a re-informing. She was never informed by any physician with regards to the detrimental effects, the risk associated with this antibiotic.
We don't know that, Your Honor. The doctor that prescribed this medication was an infectious disease physician.
Right.
She took the witness stand and testified. She was never asked questions about the medication prescribed and risk and benefits disclosed to the patient. And the reason that happened, as we pointed out in our brief, informed consent was not a part of this case until the very last witness. That patient got up on the witness stand and got off. I'm sorry, the witness, Dr. Mangino, the infectious disease physician, got up on a witness stand. She was cross-examined. Direct examination was taken of her. That issue was never raised with her because the issue of informed consent was not a part of the case.
It wasn't pled?
It was pled, yes, but during
now,
the
discussion. Now, wait a minute. Either it was in the pleadings and was a justiciable issue at trial, or it wasn't.
We don't agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
And this is the reason why. After in a medical malpractice case, once the issues are pled, and we pled, as we do,
I understand.
Comparative negligence all the time. But during the course of discovery, which focuses on the issues that are going to go to court, there were four expert witnesses identified by the plaintiff. All of these physicians were deposed, their opinions discovered. We were prepared to try the case, as the plaintiffs were, on the issue of negligence.
Well, it was tried on that issue.
On negligence?
Yes.
Not on the lack of informed consent.
Well, as I review the interrogatories, there was a finding on the negligence in favor of Dr. McGregor.
Yes.
And the other issue submitted to the jury was on informed consent.
Over our objection, Your Honor, because that issue was never disclosed during discovery as one of the issues that was going to be tried in the case. None of the experts presented testimony.
But you said it was pled in the complaint.
Yes. But during the...
Where is it that we could determine that it wasn't part of the case?
Well,
obviously,
actually,
whatever anyone pleads is what they assume the burden of trying to prove and becomes the contested issue for the jury to find with respect to the facts.
Your Honor, during the course of the trial, and I believe we've cited it in our brief, when the plaintiff first raised the issue on direct examination, she was asked a question about being advised about risk and benefits and what she would have done if she had been told.
Yes.
We objected.
Yes.
To that testimony.
What was the
basis of the objection? Was informed consent, and I quote, informed consent is not a part of this case.
Yes.
That objection was sustained by the trial court. That is in the record, and it is in our brief.
So what you're saying is the court precluded testimony on this subject, but submitted it to the jury? I guess I don't understand your argument here.
Well, that's what happened.
Well, what is your argument then? That the verdict of the court?
Our argument was that when we had our conference with the court regarding the instructions that were going to be presented, plaintiffs submitted a charge on lack of informed consent. And there was a very heated discussion on the record about the applicability of a lack of informed consent charge without, as we raised on our at the appellate level, first, the issue was not disclosed during discovery, testimony was never presented, and therefore the lack of informed consent charge was not appropriate in this case.
So that was an argument as an assignment of error that you presumably presented to the Court of Appeals, and they've resolved it. And now the matter is here on a legal issue as to whether the elements of informed consent pursuant to Nickel are complete, or whether or not there is an additional element which is implicit in the definition of an informed consent tort. Right?
I think I follow what you're saying, Your Honor. But implicit in our appeal here is whether or not there is a duty in the first place, which should have been established by a medical expert witness, that an attending physician that simply transfers medications previously provided by other specialists, whether that doctor has a duty to sit down and explain a duty by law to sit down with that patient. That duty should be established if it arises through an expert witness.
You're actually arguing two positions. One, I didn't try this issue to the court, but they found on it. And two, the issue that I didn't try, the elements of the tort are at least at issue.
Yes.
But the jury findings are against you, and the Court of Appeals findings are against you. And
well,
what is it you're asking this court to do? It just seems like you haven't really joined issues with respect to what the case is about with your opposing counsel.
Well, what I've asked the court to do, we agree with the conclusion of the appellate court, and that is that an expert witness is required to establish the duty and the scope of that duty with in terms of proving a lack of informed consent. The issue I'm trying to describe for the lower court is what happened. And what happened was there was no expert witness testimony to establish the duty of this particular physician. And that, in the Court of Appeals decision,
so you
made
are
that
over
assumption.
On the, excuse me, you are over then on the legal issue of what are the proper elements of the tort of informed consent. That's what you want us to address.
Yes.
All right.
The
maladies of the trial are really historical information for our input, but really don't really hit what the key issue for this court to consider with respect to defining for our state what constitutes the tort of informed consent in a medical malpractice context.
I think so, Your Honor. I think no one disputes what the elements of the lack of informed consent is. The Nickel case spells out the elements of the lack of informed consent.
Well, that's what your opposing counsel wants us to do, just adhere to that law because everybody understands it.
Well, but I don't understand his statement that Ohio law, as it stands right now, does not require a expert witness to establish duty and scope of duty in the lack of informed consent. That's incorrect. What he is talking about is the testimony regarding materiality. A patient still may testify regarding what is material to him or her, but materiality and the reasonable patient standard goes to causation.
Well, did you have an opportunity to submit an interrogatory to the jury as to whether or not Dr. McGregor did or did not deviate from the acceptable standards with respect to the tort of informed consent? Or could you not have asked another interrogatory with respect to the expectations of the reasonable patient?
Well, I could have, Your Honor, but I was defending Dr. McGregor, and I wasn't asking for the charge of informed consent, so I wasn't going to submit interrogatories on that issue.
But you clearly knew that there was interrogatory 5 being submitted.
Yes, I did.
Counsel, if I could clarify here, the tort of informed consent in Nichols in 1985, we had three separate things that we've said. The physician fails to disclose the material risks, the unrevealed risks and dangers which should have been disclosed actually materialize and are cause of injury to the patient, and third, the reasonable person in position of the patient would have decided against the therapy. Those are the three points that create the tort of informed consent. I had thought that we were talking about informed consent in a sense as a subset of a medical negligence claim in general, or put it another way, that breach of duty for a physician always needs to be established. The duty itself needs to be established at trial by an expert. Can
yes.
you comment on that? Because the concern about Nickel versus Gonzalez, or what we do with that case in light of any disposition here, it's important to make sure we harmonize. We want to hear your position on that.
Well, The only issue maybe I've confused the court, and I apologize for that, but Nickel Gonzalez assumes that there is a duty, and it states the elements. It points out that there has to be a disclosure of risk to a patient. There has to be the scope of the disclosure is defined, and the patient and those risks have to occur as a result of what happened, and the patient would not have accepted those risks. The only difference, I don't see anything wrong with Nickel. I think it states the elements very correctly. But Nickel doesn't talk about the need of an expert witness to establish those elements.
Nichols doesn't talk about the term duty at all in
that's
the opinion.
That's correct.
And you're saying that's fine, we don't need to create a specific statement on duty?
I think that the court should specify that before a lack of informed consent charge can be given to a jury, a physician must establish, an expert witness must establish that a particular doctor, especially in a multi-specialty setting where there's multiple overlapping care of a patient, has a duty independently to disclose certain risks and benefits to that patient. And I apologize for how I opened up the argument, but I wanted to establish that this duty issue with Dr. McGregor was never established, that he had the responsibility as a physician that was just transferring medication orders that were ordered by another physician.
Would that be a factual issue, or would that be a legal issue?
Oh, I think it's a legal issue, Your Honor. Well, I mean, it's a combination of both.
You don't need an expert to say that.
No, I think
you wouldn't want to, we wouldn't want a doctor saying, well, and when there are three or four doctors involved and the specialist is initial writer of the prescription, that the treating physician who writes another prescription upon release of the patient has either has a duty or does not have a duty to inform the patient. You know, do you think that's, if it's a legal question, then a doctor wouldn't testify to that, would he or she?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor.
Isn't that for us to decide?
I think that's for you to decide. I think in a medical malpractice case that everything turns on the use of an expert witness to establish the confines of the case, what the duty is of a physician or multiple sets of physicians, what their responsibilities are, and whether they met those responsibilities through standard of care.
Let me ask you, if we go through the Nickel test, I think there is a duty that's created because it says the physician fails to disclose the patient discussment. That certainly, at least by implication, says there is a duty, is a tort if the doctor does not do that. So it seems to me there is a duty for the doctor. The statute is saying, or the court is saying, that a doctor has, take out the issue of the multiple doctors, but a doctor has a duty to disclose to the patient of the material risks and dangers. Here we have, in this case, we have abundant evidence, it seems to me, that the patient should have, that the drug that was prescribed caused the tubular problem.
Vestibular.
Right. Yes. So that's established. Why do we need an expert to say that when Nickel says the failure to disclose, why do we need a doctor to say, well, there should have been a disclosure to the patient by the defendant here of the problems that could occur? Why can't the jury say, well, we see what happened, we see what drug was administered, it caused this problem, and the patient says she would like to have had the opportunity to decide whether to take that drug. Why do we need an expert to say that the doctor should have, that the treating physician here should have advised the patient? Because the Nickel says there's a duty to do that.
You know, I agree that Nickel says there is a duty. But why do we need an expert? Since the Bruni versus Tatsumi case, there's been a litany of cases from this court that says that when you are dealing with professional care, a medical expert is required to prove the case. In this case, it would be a reasonably prudent physician in the same or similar circumstance. Could the plaintiffs present a neurologist that doesn't have any information or knowledge about the use and dosage and frequency of gentamicin in the treatment of an epidural infection? I don't think that could be done. I think that the law requires that if you're going to have testimony regarding a lack of informed consent, that a reasonably prudent physician skilled in a similar area of a particular physician can testify that a doctor that prescribed this medication or some other doctor along with that physician that was working with that patient both had a duty or one had a duty to make sure this patient was informed of the risk and benefits of
So, counsel, you're not so much asking for the determination if you knew it was going to be an informed consent case, and you're saying you didn't, even though it was pled, that it's not so much a failure to disclose in establishing what the risks were with the taking of this medication. An expert should have been on the stand to almost talk about the ethics of whose duty it was.
I'm not sure it was ethics, but I think there had to be someone to testify that a particular physician had a responsibility to this patient to disclose medication.
Out of the physicians that were treating this woman from start to finish.
That's correct.
And therefore, the expert was necessary to establish not what the duty was and not whether the duty was carried out, but whose duty it was.
That's correct. In this scenario, in this case, most likely the infectious disease doctor or prescribing physician would have the responsibility, one would assume, would have the responsibility if they prescribe a medication, to advise that patient what the risk and benefits would be.
But this isn't a case about whose duty is it. This is a case about whether or not the physician in question deviated from what would have been the conduct of another physician in similarly situated circumstances, isn't it? So you're really asking for an expert to testify that the conduct of the physician in this case did or did not deviate from the acceptable standards in that community, professional standards of that physician.
That's correct. For a neurosurgeon.
You're saying that the plaintiff failed to establish that.
That's correct.
And in effect, the plaintiff is saying, look, I just didn't have a duty to do that. I had a duty to demonstrate what the problems were, according to the nickel, but there's nothing that says that I have to establish that, because all I have to establish is that I didn't receive that consent.
Correct, Your Honor.
So you see this as a gap in nickel, or you think nickel is complete?
No, I don't think anything's wrong with nickel. I think nickel makes the implied assumption as the...
You think that this testimony is implied in nickel?
Yes. It's assumed that there was a duty established that a physician had to make the disclosures. This case raises the issue of whether or not a physician has that duty to obtain a patient's informed consent when he can rely on another physician that's already prescribed the drug.
So that when we have new drugs coming out, every physician who chooses to prescribe that drug to every patient, regardless of what it may be, has the duty, presumably, to inform the patients of all of the consequences if, in fact, they take that drug.
Well, that's part of the medical treatment. If a physician prescribes medicine to a patient, I think it would be an reasonable expectation of a patient that the prescribing physician would explain the benefits and risk of treatment, which may include medications.
And do we need, if that is so, do we need an expert to come forward and testify that that is a reasonable expectation of a similarly situated medical professional?
I think
if your statement is that every patient just expects that.
Well, I think a patient, I would expect it. I think anyone in the courtroom would expect to have an explanation of risk and benefits. But in a malpractice case, if you're going to file a lawsuit that a physician did something wrong, we need, as I said, there's a litany of cases that a expert witness must establish, because it's a professional case, that a particular doctor didn't do something that a reasonably prudent physician would do in the same or similar circumstance. I don't see any way around that, and that is the argument here that didn't happen. It just, we are starting from scratch. Nichols doesn't start from scratch. But there's nothing wrong with the Nickel case. It just assumes there was a duty in place.
Well, in Nickel, there was an operation. There was one doctor, and it was talking about the proposed therapy. Would the patient have had the operation if all these things had been disclosed by the doctor? Is that correct?
Correct.
Here we're talking about multiple physicians. Who is the one that's supposed to give the explanation of side effects of this particular medication?
That's correct. Now, that's correct.
We've taken you well beyond your time, Mr. Todaro. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Losey, you saved 35 seconds, but take a minute since we took Mr. Todaro beyond.
Mr. Todaro says it perfectly. We as patients expect to be informed by our physicians. In this case, Mrs. Badger was not informed. Nobody came in and said she was informed. She testified she was not informed. The material risks were not explained to her. Nickel versus Gonzalez does not set forth a duty that we have to have an expert physician for that purpose.
But what about Dr. McGregor when there are a number of physicians involved here? Do we know that it was she should have been informed, absolutely. Who was the one that should have informed her?
In this case, Dr. McGregor had a duty to Mrs. Badger. The 10th District Appellate Court looked at this. He was the attending physician. He wrote the prescription. There are two reasons here to find that duty. Mrs. Badger's looking to her attending physician to help her.
I think Mr. Todaro's, at least by implication, argument is that, yeah, Dr. McGregor wrote the prescription, but he wrote it because a specialist had written it initially, and that if the specialist decided this was the appropriate drug for her to take, that as the treating physician, I'm comfortable in continuing that prescription. That does give us the dilemma, does it not, or the issue of does the duty fall on every physician who treats the patient, or does it fall on only certain physicians who treat the patient? That really wasn't briefed, I don't think, to the extent that I don't know what other courts have done in other states, but we can obviously find out. But on that issue, if that's the issue we decide, but there does seem to be at least a side issue here.
This was a very material risk to Mrs. Badger. Dr. McGregor, under oath, says he was very much aware of these. Did he question Dr. Mangino about whether or not she informed her? Can he rely on someone else to do his job? It's my position that a physician prescribing such a risky medication has a duty to check and to make sure that patient knows what they're in for.
Thank you, Mr. Losey.
The
case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.